Hello, it's Wednesday, February the 18th, 2009. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, Polly Toynbee on the government's failure to meet child poverty targets.
To hit the target by 2010, the halfway mark for abolishing child poverty, they would need to have put a great deal more money in. They'd need to put in another £4.1 billion.
Our employers set to cut wages as we edge closer towards deflation.
If we really get stuck into sort of deflationary spiral, then that's very bad for people with big debts because it actually means the price of your debt gets higher.
Today's alternative thought for the day comes from the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain.
Contrary to claims of promoting social cohesion and minority rights, Sharia in Britain is actually a capitulation to political Islam.
We speak to the man behind President Obama's hugely successful online campaign.
We didn't elect Barack Obama, we ran his fan club. I mean, we're the sort of first to admit that. We happen to now have a diverse company and we're doing a lot of different things, but we just happened to help elect the president, so it felt pretty good.
First, a news update and a paper review with Sandy Waugh.
The government will fail to meet its target of halving child poverty by next year unless more than £4 billion extra is spent on the problem. This is according to a study released today by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. The report shows the majority of children living in poverty now have at least one parent in work, but they're earning so little they're unable to drag their family above the poverty line. Any household with children where parents have an income of less than 60% of British median income is classed as in poverty. The government conceded more needed to be done, but no commitment to spending more was given. The president of Syria has urged the United States to rebuild diplomatic ties with his country. President Bashar al-Assad, speaking exclusively to The Guardian, said Syria expects the US to send an ambassador to Damascus soon. This follows Barack Obama's offer to engage in dialogue with countries the Bush administration shunned. However, an official from the US State Department claimed relations with Syria remain under review. You can read the full interview at guardian.co.uk/Syria. Sir Alan Stanford, the Texan billionaire and cricket promoter, has been charged over an alleged $8 billion fraud, according to American authorities. Stanford achieved fame in Britain last year when he put forward $20 million for a one-off cricket match between England and a West Indian All-Stars team. Last night, the England and Wales Cricket Board moved to suspend ties between themselves and Stanford. The latest alleged scandal comes after renegade Wall Street fund manager Bernie Madoff was charged in connection with a $50 billion fraud in December. Investor Warren Buffett believes there could be more such scandals. He said it's only when the tide goes out that you learn who's been swimming naked. 700 British troops seized four Taliban narcotics factories containing £50 million worth of drugs and killed 20 enemy fighters, the Ministry of Defence said today. Operation Diesel, which took place in southern Afghanistan earlier this month, involved marine commandos, infantry and an airborne assault. John Hutton, the Defence Secretary, praised the British troops. He said the seizure would starve the Taliban of funding, preventing the proliferation of drugs and terror in the UK. Meanwhile, President Barack Obama has authorised the deployment of up to 17,000 extra US troops to Afghanistan. He said they're to meet urgent security needs. In cricket, England have taken control of the third test in Antigua on a day that was overshadowed by the arrest of Sir Alan Stanford. Five wickets from Graham Swan helped England take a commanding first innings lead. Follow the day's play from 2pm on guardian.co.uk/cricket. Now for a look at today's papers, and The Telegraph warns millions face a pay freeze as inflation continues to fall. Gordon Brown lays out in a comment piece for The Times his four-point plan to end the excesses of the bonus culture in banks. There must be no reward for failure, he writes. However, a report in the Financial Times claims the Royal Bank of Scotland will pay up to £950 million in staff bonuses, despite a huge taxpayer-funded bailout. An investigation on the front of The Independent reveals tons of toxic waste is being sent illegally to Africa for processing. The Express and The Mail both lead on figures released by the think tank Migration Watch, showing 3.8 million jobs in Britain are held by foreign workers, 13% of the total workforce. Meanwhile, The Sun leads with news that the so-called Yorkshire Ripper Peter Sutcliffe could soon be released from the top security hospital Broadmoor. More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
First, we ask, how is Labour doing in tackling child poverty? Having set itself aspirational targets a year after being elected in 1997, is the government in line to keep its promises? Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee has been assessing Mr. Blair and Mr. Brown's performance.
Back in 1998, Tony Blair announced what was probably the most ambitious and extraordinary of Labour's policies. He announced that they would abolish all child poverty by the year 2020. He said it to a room full of poverty experts who were absolutely astounded. You could see their jaws drop because they knew how very difficult it would be. Britain has one of the highest rates of child poverty in the Western world, only America really higher. And that mostly is as a result of what happened in the 1980s, of what happened during that recession and during the Thatcher years. When in 1979, when Labour left office, one in seven children were poor. By the end of the 1980s, one in three children were poor, and that's what Labour inherited. So Tony Blair was determined to show that, in the end, the most important thing that a Labour government can do is to redistribute money to the very poorest families. And it has been ambitious, and it's been partially successful. But today's figures from this new report from the Rowntree Foundation, which does most of the monitoring of child poverty, suggest that they're going to be off by a long way. To hit the target by 2010, the halfway mark for abolishing child poverty, they would need to have put a great deal more money in. They'd need to put in another £4.1 billion. And they'd need to do that in this next upcoming budget in April. Well, is a government in this much trouble financially likely to find that kind of money? And after all, it's not just a one-off £4.1 billion, it's year after year after year. But if they don't do that, what this report shows quite convincingly and pretty definitely is that the government will only reach two-thirds of its target. For the halfway mark, not the whole way there, which will be a big disappointment. It'll be one of the things that the Tories, if they come to power, will be able to say, well, look, Labour never achieved it, so we shall probably abandon the target too. And that will be a great sadness for Labour supporters and one of Labour's great failures, even though they've done more to lift more children out of poverty than any other government has ever before.
The Guardian's Polly Toynbee. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, did the Department of Transport help industry dodge climate change laws? Find out at guardian.co.uk/politics. Police are alerted 100 times a month to online predators by children pressing the report abuse button. The full story at guardian.co.uk/UK. You've seen what Victoria Beckham has to offer. Now see how the seasoned designers do it with the latest from New York Fashion Week. Pictures and bitchiness abound at guardian.co.uk/life and style. And slurping is the best way to enjoy a new Starbucks instant coffee. Details at guardian.co.uk/business. Next, in the words of the Liberal Democrat Treasury spokesman Vince Cable, it's becoming more likely that for the foreseeable future, there is a higher risk of deflation than inflation. It's the kindest way of putting the imminent likelihood that the credit crisis could be as bad as the most pessimistic doom-mongers predicted. Inflation is down for a fourth straight month, and in a deflationary economy, we could see employers looking to maintain levels of pay or even reduce them. Our business editor Deborah Hargreaves looks at what we can expect.
Consumer price inflation is 3%. That's down from 3.1% in December, which is a much smaller fall than expected. But the more interesting one is retail price inflation, which is down to 0.1%, so taking us very close to deflationary territory.
And the difference between the two?
The difference between the two is that RPI has included mortgage interest rates and house prices. So they're obviously falling very fast. And the gap between the two measures is the biggest it's been for 15 years. Now, this causes all sorts of interest to statisticians, obviously. But the most important thing is that RPI is used for most people in their wage bargaining. So few pay rises next year, if anyone thought they were going to get any.
Are we going to get pay cuts as opposed to pay rises, do you think?
Well, if we go into deflationary territory, we might end up giving back some of our money to our employers. Only joking. I hope.
Now, deflation is a good thing, isn't it, in the short term, but not in the long term. Can you clarify that for us?
If you keep your job and you're obviously employed and you feel quite secure, deflation can be quite a good thing for you because it basically means that the price of everything is coming down, so you can afford to buy more. But if we really get stuck into sort of deflationary spiral, then that's very bad for people with big debts because it actually means the price of your debt gets higher or more difficult to service.
And as your wages go down or stay the same, bills such as council taxes, they don't, do they?
Fixed bills stay the same. And obviously, it's very difficult to, if you're earning less, to carry on paying for your bills.
Now, another story that you're running in today's paper is the government telling RBS to rein in its bonuses.
That's right. Obviously, we've seen a political furore over bonus payouts, and now the government is really getting tough on RBS in particular and telling it to cut its bonus pool from £1 billion to £175 million. So this means that far fewer bonuses will be paid by RBS than were previously planned. And it basically means that unless you're contractually obliged to a bonus, you won't get one.
So who does that include?
That mostly includes investment bankers that were taken over in the big ABN AMRO deal when RBS bought the Dutch bank last year.
Which is still the fat cat.
It is a bit ironic, actually, because that's the deal that broke the bank and those bankers that were taken on are being rewarded. But the people in the branches look like getting nothing.
And there's no way of getting out of those contracts.
Well, so the government says. I'm not convinced myself because those contracts have never really been challenged in court. Most people say that employment contracts are fairly sacrosanct and you have to honour them. I don't know. I'd quite like to see them come into court and see if you could challenge them, actually.
This is Guardian Daily. I'm Mike Duran. Still to come, can Gus Hiddink get his highly paid players fit enough to win anything?
He clearly wants to improve the fitness of the squad. That was a common criticism of the Scolari regime.
Before that, the alternative thought for the day. Today we hear from Mariam Namazi, spokeswoman for the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain.
1 year on, the Archbishop of Canterbury has once again defended his comments on Sharia law. Just the word itself is for me like a kick in the stomach. I find myself trying to catch my breath every time I hear it being uttered. I mean, Sharia is why so many of us have fled and are fleeing Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan and elsewhere to get as far away from it as possible, only to have it repackaged and sold to us by the US-led liberators in Iraq and Afghanistan or by the Archbishop of Canterbury in Britain as the next best thing to sliced bread. Contrary to claims of promoting social cohesion and minority rights, Sharia in Britain is actually a capitulation to political Islam. Just as the Pakistani government's agreement to allow the imposition of Sharia in the northwest this very week is an attempt to placate and appease the Islamists. It has nothing to do with freedom of religion and belief or rights and choices. In fact, the stronger and more pervasive its hold, the less freedoms, rights and choices people, and particularly women, have. Yes, of course, there's a difference between letting Islamic courts and councils decide on civil matters rather than criminal ones. But the difference is a matter of degree. The fundamentals are the same. Losing custody of your child at a preset age, irrespective of the child's welfare, being told to remain in an abusive relationship, or having your forced marriage at 13 stamped with the approval of these sham courts can be just as destructive. In fact, discriminatory family and personal status codes are important pillars in the oppression of women in Islamic states. And much of the struggle for women's rights is taking shape in countries like Iran against these very aspects of Sharia. Moreover, rather than promote minority rights and social cohesion, Sharia law promotes fragmentation and social conflict. It imposes different standards and norms for so-called different people. It denies universal and equal rights fought for and established by progressive social and working class movements over centuries. It gives precedence to the most regressive cultural and religious norms of the ruling elite rather than to human beings and their rights and lives. Opposing Sharia law in Britain, as in Afghanistan or elsewhere, isn't an attack on people's right to religion. It's a defense of people's human rights. After all, rights, equality, and respect are for real live human beings, not for beliefs, and certainly not for inhumane political movements.
Mariam Namazi. And tomorrow we hear from the editor of The Philosopher's Magazine and author of Atheism, A Short Introduction, Julian Baghini.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Now, Thomas Gensemer is a name you may not be familiar with, but without his help, America could have inaugurated President McCain. The 31-year-old is the man behind President Obama's slick online campaign. It was his website, my.barackobama.com, which recruited 13.5 million supporters and raised $500 million. Here, he talks to The Guardian's Sarah Phillips.
You know, more than a billion emails were sent in the course of the 22-month campaign, some probably too many to some people, but at each point, you then know how people engage with your content. So they donated this amount of money, they gave this comment, they uploaded this picture, they did this thing, which allows you to just ever deepen the relationship. The other way sort of it worked was, and perhaps the biggest way, is that the program was integrated into the nuts and bolts of the political operation. So the field operation on the ground in the battleground state sort of knew what capacity was being generated from the online audience. The sort of relationship between traditional campaigning and the technology underpinnings was established from day one, and it was became a mandate from the top of the campaign to use it to allow essentially Barack Obama was a community organizer 20 years ago, and the only way of scaling that is effectively using technology. So those two things are sort of the simplicity of email and the organizational buy-in for the program are sort of how it all happened. I think $500 million helps someone realize that it is pretty important. I think he and his immediate advisors understood from day one that they would have popular appeal. Now, we weren't hired until 10 days before the announcement address, so they knew that they were also a little bit behind the ball. Don't allow yourself to be mystified by technology. Allow it to complement your organization. So, and again, to the simplicity of email, there are now, I don't think, many politicians, save John McCain perhaps, who don't use email. You know, you can talk to MPs who are well into their 70s that are at least reading constituent email and understand that it's a different world than you know, pen writing. And so that 70-year-old MP is probably not Twittering, for example. And so don't pretend that you are because you think that's what people want. What people want is an authentic relationship that just happens to be online. I challenge clients, especially in early parts of the relationship with clients, if this room were filled with 100 people, forget about technology, what would you ask them to do? And if you can't answer that question, your problem's not technology. It's sort of old school politics.
How are you applying this for the anti-BMP campaign that you're working on?
We're focusing on, one, making it incredibly easy and meaningful to just sign up for the email list, of branding the organization as this effort that has, in very tangible ways, the ability to stop the BMP from representing the British people in the European Parliament. You know, starting with that basis and articulating it really clearly. In this case, I think the numbers are like, they only need 8% to get a seat, and then therefore all of you, I won't say me because I'm not a citizen, would be represented by someone in the BMP. That's not just something that should cause outrage. We're saying, here and do something about it. Give 20 quid today and this is how it will be spent defeating it. Or get involved in a more active volunteerism way. It's making the barrier to entry so low to the program and making people realize that an individual action today, a day of volunteering, a couple of quid, can make a real difference. Making it very practical. The argument that sort of my core voter isn't online is nonsense now in the first world country. You know, even if it's not 100% or even 50%, there's still a healthy segment that are more prone to read your emails than to read your direct mail.
Sarah Phillips talking to Thomas Gensemer, the man behind my.barackobama.com. And you can watch Mr. Gensemer online at guardian.co.uk/video, appraising political websites here in the UK. Finally this Wednesday, The Guardian's Dominic Fifield has been spending time with 3,000 to 4,000 Chelsea fans at Gus Hiddink's first open training session. As players were announced to the crowd, the captain was introduced as John Terry, the man who will stay at Chelsea forever. Assigned to Manchester City, they want to keep their man. But what else can we learn from the new manager's public display?
Well, we learnt a bit more about
Gus Hiddink's plans for the weekend. They've got a very crucial game this weekend at Aston Villa, who are immediately above them in the Premiership table at the moment. And we were treated to an almost full-sided practice game towards the end of the session. Tennyside it was, and it was clearly a first team that started wearing bibs. And then they've made a couple of changes at half-time in their practice game. So I think we've got a good idea of who he's considering for the game at the weekend. In terms of his general style and what he's going to be asking of Chelsea, I don't think this was an occasion really for that. I think he clearly wants to improve the fitness of the squad. That was a common criticism of the Scolari regime at the club. And in front of the fans, if the fans had been presented with 20 players jogging around the pitch, they wouldn't have really accepted that, I think. So this was more for show in that respect. But there was some decent tactical stuff. Not always good to see a team train in some ways. It is amazing to see the close ball control they have, and when they do their keep ball sessions and small-sided games, it is impressive to watch. But in terms of the long term, I don't think we saw anything today. But maybe short term for Aston Villa, we did.
Well, let's talk about fitness first from the perspective of Hiddink and then from the players. Reports following Hiddink's first training session said that he didn't believe the team were fit enough, as you say. I mean, could that be read as implicit criticism of his predecessor?
Well, yes, definitely. I think that there's an acceptance that the Chelsea squad players themselves were frustrated at the lack of intensity, perceived lack of intensity under Luis Felipe Scolari. So it doesn't come as a huge surprise that Hiddink is addressing this problem immediately. In some ways, I'd be surprised if he hadn't, deemed that from his first few sessions with the team. It's not that they're unfit. It's more that they're seeking something, a greater intensity, a greater work rate in training sessions. And Scolari was very relaxed in training, and there'd be an awful lot of keep ball possession games, but that's not great for working on fitness and particularly for the end of games and end of Premiership matches. So
players who've been linked with those criticisms would include Anelka, which is strange as he is currently the Premiership top scorer, and Balak, although he is now saying that he played no role in Scolari's sacking.
But, I mean, I think that the whole root of Anelka's frustrations, even though he scored 20 goals this season, was that towards the end of Scolari's reign, he was increasingly thrust out onto the right wing. And I don't see that happening quite so often under Hiddink.
I mean, finally there, you mentioned team options for Hiddink. Scolari blames his demise, one of the reasons, on a lack of a magical player. Does Hiddink think he has captain unbeatable on his team?
Well, he played Deco as a sort of deep-lying midfielder in the practice game, sort of almost like a quarterback from American football. I don't see it that working necessarily in the Premier League. I think especially if Chelsea are going to daunting venues like Villa Park, against an Aston Villa side playing very well. They'll probably want a defensive shield in that midfield rather than a creative player deep lying. I think that criticism of Chelsea, the lack of creation, the lack of a player with a spark, a dribbler like a Robinho, or even a Deco from 5-6 years ago, is going to persist until the summer when they can actually address it and maybe look to bring people in. I don't see Hiddink waving a magic wand on that front. I don't think he'd expect to either.
Dominic Fifield. That's it for today's podcast. You can download the latest version tomorrow from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today, Peter Sale and Phil Maynard. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.